From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, brides in China are choosier about whom they marry. European horse trainers criticize drug use in American horse racing, and Egypt has a Jon Stewart of its own. We begin our podcast with a tour of Sao Paulo, Brazil, through the eyes of artists. 20 million people live in Sao Paulo, and some artists are not only taking inspiration from that urban landscape, they are trying to give something back. Here's our South America correspondent, Lourdes Garcia Navarro.
I'm standing in the heart of the financial district of Sao Paulo. Just to set the scene, I'm surrounded by tall buildings made of glass and people walking back and forth at the busy lunchtime wearing suits and business wear. And in front of me is Leticia Matos, who is, for want of a better word, a crochet artist. Leticia couldn't look more different. She's in a short-sleeve shirt and she's covered in bright, quirky tattoos. She tells me about a year ago she got her idea while knitting and crocheting with her friends. She says she covers trees and street poles with woolen sleeves and pom-poms, small yarn balls. Her works look like whimsical webs of rainbow yarn. The effect is surprising and oddly comforting. I want people to have something familiar in the city, she says. Here in Brazil, we teach knitting from mother to daughter. When they see my art, people suddenly feel comfortable walking these cold streets. You can feel better, she says. So as you can hear behind me, I'm at one of the quintessential urban sites, and that is a construction site. And I'm with Laura Guimarães, and she's a different kind of artist. She's been inspired by the digital world.
Vestiu sua melhor roupa, que não era das melhores, e fingiu elegância, tentando não pensar na água.
She recites, he put on his best clothes, even though they weren't of the best quality, pretending elegance, trying not to think of the water seeping into the hole in his shoe. Behind her, plastered on the boards protecting the building site, are dozens of what she calls her microscripts. I'm a screenwriter originally, she tells me, and I was inspired by Twitter to capture a moment, a scene, in a few words that would fire people's imagination, she says. I print them and put them up across the city. I've also studied the history of street art, she says. There is a movement in Sao Paulo now. When I started, there was almost nothing like this. This is an oppressive city, she says. Some people take 3 hours to get to work. People don't have time here, and so you have to put art in front of them, she says, so they have no option but to see it. It's food for the soul, she says. The newest and biggest project here is called Color Plus City, and it's got an impressive list of corporate sponsors. The idea is to hook up graffiti artists with individuals or business owners who have a wall they want covered with original art.
My name is Guilherme Matsumoto, but in the streets I use the name XGX.
Guilherme says he saw the website on the internet and signed up to say he was available to paint a wall. The owner of the Purple House Hostel, Walter Orsatti, responded. It was that easy, they say. The mural is a splash of color on an otherwise bland residential street.
What we've got here is a big fish about to eat a man holding a little fish.
Yeah. It's like the hunting day, you know. Sometimes you are the hunt, sometimes you are the hunted.
Sometimes you are the hunter and sometimes you're the prey.
Yeah.
Orsatti says he didn't want to influence the work.
And I told him, make your art. Be free to do whatever you want.
Color Plus City has already spread throughout Brazil, and the hope is to take it to the rest of the world. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Sao Paulo.
Women hold up half the sky. That is the famous quote by the late Chairman Mao. And in today's rapidly changing China, that may be more true than ever. Chinese tradition favors boys, and with China's one-child policy firmly in place, the result is that for every 100 Chinese girls born, there are 117 boys. By the end of this decade, some 24 million Chinese men will be unable to find a wife. As NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Beijing, that means prospective Chinese brides can afford to be choosier and more demanding than ever before.
It's Derek Wei's big day, his wedding day. He arrives at his bride's house early in the morning. As tradition demands, the door is locked. With his groomsmen, he bangs on the door. The bride, Lucy Wang, her little niece and her bridesmaids are refusing to open up. They want red packets of money first. This is a traditional wedding custom, and the women play along by complaining noisily about his stinginess. This is the last in a series of financial transactions that accompanies this and every Chinese wedding, as Derek explains.
It's like a negotiation. What do you need to get married? What can I provide? When we reach a deal, we discuss, what does your family want? What does my family have to bargain with?
Now Derek is getting nervous they'll be late. I love you, wife, he shouts. Let me in. From the other side of the door, his future wife, Lucy, demands a song. Her demands have been for more than just music. Although Lucy has an office job in Beijing, she's from Shanxi province. Wedding customs there demand the groom gives his future in-laws a big betrothal gift, traditionally known as the bride price. Derek handed over 68,888 yuan, a lucky figure, which is more than $10,000. Lucy, however, was not so impressed.
There are lots of coal mine owners where I come from, so they push the prices up. In an ordinary family, the betrothal gift is about $10,000. To be honest, where I'm from, that's hardly anything.
Finally, the men lose patience and force their way into the room. Derek's on his knees. It's the first time he's seen his wife on their big day. A massive grin on his face, a bunch of pink roses for Lucy. His first thought on hearing of the betrothal gift was pure fear. Most young men getting married in China today are expected to fork out, often providing an apartment, sometimes a car and a betrothal gift too. Things were so much easier when his parents got married 4 decades ago.
My parents' wedding was very simple. You can't even imagine how simple it was. They had a bed, a cupboard, a bike, and a sewing machine. That was China in the 70s.
This is China in the 21st century. And amid a hail of firecrackers, the happy couple make their way to a roast duck restaurant, where their celebration will be held. Their MC is Lucy's former classmate, Frank Jiang, who got married 12 years ago. He's amazed at the difference a decade makes. On his wedding day, he and his wife just invited their friends home for a meal.
Very simple wedding.
What did you give her? Did you give her money?
No.
Did you give her an apartment?
No.
Did you give her a car?
No. No.
Did you spend any money?
When my wife went to my family first time, my parents just gave her 888 RMB.
At that time, maybe it was about $100 or so.
Today, as the newlyweds toast their family and friends, it's a sobering reminder of how the gender imbalance and new wealth is changing China. What Frank's wife got 12 years ago is a hundredth of what Derek handed over as a betrothal gift. In total, Derek spent about 1 year's salary on the bride price and gold jewelry. On top of that, he's expected to provide an apartment for his new wife. His parents' home is about to be demolished, and they'll get 2 new flats in compensation. Derek is counting on them to give him one as the marital home. Nowadays, 70% of Chinese women believe a man should provide an apartment along with a marriage offer, according to one official survey. In economic terms, the relative scarcity of women is giving them bargaining power. These women's demands are making China's economy grow even faster.
Revenue sector ratios contribute to 2 percentage points of GDP growth.
2 percentage points of GDP growth stems from the gender gap, as men compete to attract a wife. That's according to research by Xiaobo Zhang, an economics professor at Peking University. He sees the competition among men to attract a wife playing out in real estate as they buy bigger and bigger apartments. His research has found that almost half the growth in real estate prices is due to the gender imbalance.
In order to save more, families with sons must work harder. They are more likely to become entrepreneurs, more likely to take risky jobs, like working in the construction sector, more likely to work longer hours. All this contributes to economic growth.
For his part, Derek borrowed some money for this wedding. Most young men have no choice due to the soaring cost of real estate. An urban apartment costs 15 times the average annual income of a home buyer. So parents like Derek start saving up from the moment their son is born. But some argue that women aren't necessarily benefiting. Later, Hong Fincher is writing a book on gender and home ownership in China. She believes women are being excluded from what may be the biggest accumulation of real estate wealth in history.
There are three main ways in which I argue that women have been shut out of the accumulation of real estate wealth. The first is that the parents tend to buy homes for their sons, but not for their daughters. The second is that homes tend to be registered in men's names only. And the third is that women often transfer their life savings over to the man to finance the purchase of a marital home, which is then often registered solely in the man's name.
Back at the wedding, all of this is beside the point. Lucy and Derek are planning to register their home in both their names. As a toy tank bearing the couple's rings trundles down the aisle, they drink from a champagne fountain and share a kiss. Their life together is only just starting. But soon they'll be three, a few weeks later, and they're already expecting their first child. They hope it will be a girl. "We wouldn't have to buy her an apartment," explains Lucy, "and should cost us less than a boy." Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, Ford woos Chinese drivers, a satirist risks arrest in Egypt, and a U.S.-Europe divide over drugging racehorses. Last month, an American horse won the world's richest horse race, the $10 million Dubai World Cup. The horse was former Kentucky Derby winner Animal Kingdom. It's not just the money that makes this notable. Animal Kingdom's victory highlights a big divide in the sport between America, where many horses are drugged on race day, and the rest of the world. To learn more, NPR's Eleanor Beardsley went to the races in France.
In France, horse racing season kicked off this month at the famous Longchamp Hippodrome just outside of Paris. Crowds came out to cheer and bet on sleek thoroughbreds galloping down the verdant turf course. Horse racing in Europe is different from the sport in the U.S., from the shape and surface of the track to the distance of the races and the length of the racing season. But the biggest difference is drugs. There are none allowed in European horse races. But in America, drugs aren't just legal, they're widely used, particularly furosemide, better known as Lasix, which helps prevent horses' lungs from bleeding during races.
Come on.
Jean Ararik is an American horse trainer in France. She grooms a horse at her stables in Maison Lafitte, lush horse country to the west of Paris. Rarick feels the practice of administering Lasix is ruining the sport in America.
Every horse in America starts his day with a shot or two in the neck. I'm sorry, but it's wrong. It's just wrong. The Americans will have these horror stories about, oh, if we don't use Lasix, they're going to bleed to death and drop in front of people, and how pretty is that? It's ridiculous. I mean, we don't use Lasix in the rest of the world.
The two-length win March 30th by American horse Animal Kingdom at the Dubai World Cup shows that a horse can run without Lasix, says Rarick, and it comes at a time when drugging is a top issue in the U.S. racing industry. The Breeders' Cup has banned race day drugging of two-year-olds and was going to extend that ban to all of its races this year, but last month the Breeders' Cup board rolled back on those plans, in part due to lack of support by many in the racing industry. Rarick rides one of her horses on a morning training run. She says Lasix is a powerful diuretic.
If you give a horse a shot of Lasix and then watch what happens, he'll start to pee and pee and pee. He will lose 30 pounds of body weight in fluids. It's a tremendously powerful drug.
Rarick says the horses are then so dehydrated after the race that other drugs are needed to help them recover. She describes it as a vicious circle. Animal Kingdom won the Dubai Classic clean, but when he won the Kentucky Derby in 2011, he raced on Lasix. In fact, there are 14 medications allowed in America's top horse race, says Rarick. Critics say the legal drugs help mask a raft of illegal drugs. Barry Irwin, Animal Kingdom's owner, wants the use of drugs in American racing stopped. He says 95% of American racehorses are being medicated for bleeding, a problem that only affects about 5%.
I'm more interested in not having any drugs in racing at all so that everybody can play on a level field and that we can be more in line with international sports. All other sports are getting rid of medication and we're stubbornly hanging on to one drug.
Veteran thoroughbred trainer Dale Romans disagrees. He believes using Lasix is the right thing to do and says horse racing in the rest of the world should catch up with the U.S. and modern science.
A lot of people don't realize we have this problem because they don't come back to the barn with the horse. They don't see blood running out of their nose. They don't see that they're bled inside and that it causes lung infections. So we have an inexpensive medication to prevent it from happening, and I think we should use it. I think the horse should be put first.
Tom Lute is the outgoing chairman of the board of directors of the Breeders' Cup. He says the issue of medication in the U.S. horse racing culture is extremely complicated.
It's very hard for us to compare racing here in Europe because they run a different style and they take many more seasonal breaks. We're much more commercialized here. If you look at what the horses run for in purse money in Europe versus here, it's crazy. They run for nothing except for very few races.
The use of Lasix and other race day drugs has created two worlds of horse racing, the U.S. and everywhere else. Trainer Gina Rarick wishes that weren't so.
You know, it would be nice to have an ambition of one day getting a horse good enough to run the Breeders' Cup or, you know, win the Kentucky Derby. But that's not my ambition at all because I could never run under those conditions. If they make it drug-free, yes, that would be a dream to go back and one day compete in one of the races I used to watch as a kid growing up.
But for now, Rarick says, she's more than happy to stay in this racing world. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
General Motors has been the American car company in China for years. Now Ford is making an unprecedented push to change all that. Last year, Ford's sales in China were up more than 30%, and the Ford Focus was China's best-selling car. NPR's Frank Langfitt takes us now to the Shanghai Auto Show.
Li Ning bought his first Ford, a Focus sedan, about a couple of years ago.
The biggest impression is it's very easy to drive. It feels great. The exterior is what I like, very dynamic. I like cars that look muscular and that have some sense of American style.
He was back this week, browsing for another Ford at Shanghai's sprawling auto show. Wearing glasses, a gray hoodie, and jeans, he scoured the company's exhibit of 23 models, snapping pictures along the way. Li now has a 19-month-old child. He's looking to trade up to an SUV. When it comes to car safety, I have more confidence in Ford than other brands, he says. In China's hyper-competitive market, where there's little brand loyalty, developing new customers and keeping old ones like Li is critical. To that end, Ford plans to launch 10 new vehicles in China by 2015 and open 5 new factories.
I think it's been doing very well. The volumes are growing so fast. The brand image perception is getting better.
Yang Jian is managing editor of Automotive News China. After a slow start here, Yang says, Ford is now developing an image as a trendy, stylish car for young people like Li. Despite Ford's recent gains, though, the company still has a long way to go.
Ford market shares in China is very small. I think Ford is probably not even the top 10.
In fact, Ford is number 12, with just 3% of the passenger car market here, according to LMC Automotive, a UK-based market forecasting firm. By contrast, GM is number 2 with about 10%, and Volkswagen is on top with nearly 20%.
I'm Trevor Worthington. I'm the car and SUV vehicle line director for Asia Pacific.
To help lift that market share, Ford relies on people like Worthington. He helps the company mold and shape its global vehicles to meet Chinese tastes. For instance, Worthington says Chinese customers want a car that looks and feels more impressive, especially the rear seat.
The use of the rear seat is definitely more important to a China customer, my experience, than it is maybe in the US or in Europe.
And why is that?
During the week, this vehicle is used for business. If an owner decides to take a client for a business dinner or to a meeting or pick them up or drop them off, how that customer feels sitting in the back of the car is a reflection of the person who's driving the car. It is all about making sure that they feel special, that they feel important.
We step inside a Kuga, a small Ford SUV with the same architecture as the Ford Escape. Worthington describes the adaptations for the market here.
This is a different rear seat cushion than we use anywhere else in the world. It's got more comfort and more shape. It's slightly shorter to give the maximum amount of rear leg room that we can.
Outside, Worthington points to the cosmetic touches, including chrome handles and sleek, brighter headlamps. Things, he says, consumers associate with the Chinese word daqi. Worthington explains.
It's about grand. It's about having presence. It's about being important. When we go to market research and you stand Chinese people in front of a car, they will always comment on whether the car is daqi or whether the car isn't daqi.
Zhu Bing is 24 and works in sales for General Electric. He's eyeing the Kuga, which starts at more than $31,000. Some of those carefully chosen details are resonating.
It's pretty daqi. I really like it. For example, the design of the front suits us young people. I'm attracted to the logo, and the headlamps are pretty cool.
Zhu drives his parents' Volkswagen, but he thinks VWs are for people over 30. He plans to buy a Kuga in the fall. Frank Langford, NPR News, Shanghai.
And now a story about the Egyptian man who made the Time magazine list of the most influential people in the world. And he made that list even though his job is to make people laugh. His name is Bassam Youssef. He's known as the Egyptian Jon Stewart. And he has appeared on The Daily Show, hosted by the man known as the American Jon Stewart. His last star turn was in front of Egyptian police, who arrested him for insulting Islam. Now his case is seen as a test of freedom of speech in the new Egypt. Here's NPR's Leila Fadel.
It's 9:30 p.m. on a Friday night, and Bassam Youssef's show is on TV screens at cafes throughout downtown Cairo. It's his first show since he was summoned to the prosecutor general's office to answer questions about the jokes he makes on TV. After the interrogation, he was released on about $2,200 in bail. On this night, the show opens with a joke about Bassam himself. Freedom is not free, so Bassam paid cash. While it may seem like fun and games, Youssef has become the voice of frustrated Egyptians, and there are many of them. While opposition political figures have little traction among Egyptians, Youssef's show reaches 30 million viewers a week. It is a cross-section of society that watches him, from the religious to the secular, from the young to the old. He spends a lot of time making fun of the government, of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi, and the Islamists in general. He thinks they distort his religion. Michael Talat sits on a plastic chair right in front of the TV screen in one downtown cafe with a group of young men. At a time when we can't find anything to laugh at, he cheers us up, says Talat. Indeed, it is a gloomy time in Egypt. The transition has been messy, marred by violence, human rights abuses, economic downturns, and a government struggling to find its way. And Yusuf addresses it all with humor.
I never expected that we'll have that much impact or power.
When he was summoned to the prosecutor general's office, the whole world watched. The news dominated airwaves in this region and beyond. And even his hero, John Stewart, did a 10-minute segment on Bassem.
I'm proud of actually following the guy. So now to have actually my name mentioned in the same sentence with him, that makes me proud. So, of course, I mean, he came like a mom protecting her little bear cub, you know. It was fierce.
It's a far cry from where Yusuf's career began. During Egypt's revolution in 2011, this cardiac surgeon turned comedian created the show in his laundry room and posted the videos on YouTube. Now, internet traffic spikes in the Middle East on Saturday because of the huge number of viewers watching him on YouTube. Maha Abul-Anan is the spokesperson for YouTube in the Middle East and North Africa. She calls it the Bassem Bump.
Bassem's YouTube channel is the top channel in the region in terms of traffic, in terms of views, in terms of subscribers. He leads the region in terms of how people interact with a channel on YouTube.
At his office, just above the theater, where Bassem Yusuf's show is taped in front of a live audience each week, the staff of about 32 people is back at work, brainstorming jokes and going through potential video for the next show. At lunchtime, Bassem introduces me to the staff, steals a chicken finger from someone, and leaves. I ask Mira Dasuri what she does on the show.
I'm working on, I don't want to say this. I'm going to jail. Okay, I'm working on Morsi and some of the Islamic programs. So probably I'm going to jail now.
Even in the worst of times, they joke. It is a time-honored tradition in Egypt to laugh at everything. And that humor resonates. Khaled Mansour and Shadi Alphonse are comedians who work with Bassem on the show.
The show has affected Egypt on so many levels.
And we hear people using catchphrases that we've just come up with sitting in this room. You hear it with kids, you hear it with adults. It's a weird feeling.
And despite the fact that the channel carrying the show could lose its license and Bassem Yusuf may face jail time, he says he won't back down. It's his job to push the envelope, and he won't apologize for making fun of the right wing, the leadership, or expressing his opinion.
If we back down, that would be the end of our brand. The end of our brand that we use sarcasm and humor to combat stereotypes and to combat the status quo.
Leila Faldin, NPR News, Cairo.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.